2014, and welcome to episode 161 of Tech Talk for Teachers. I'm Tom Grissom.
I'm Cindy Rich.
I'm Mike Joya.
Welcome to Tech Talk for Teachers, the show about teaching and learning with technology, and welcome to the 2014 edition. So this time we're going to be talking about Data Privacy Month, and Mike, I think you're going to do that segment.
Yes. Talk a little bit about what's going on, and I think a lot more people are aware of it.
It's on, I watched the Today Show, and it just about every single day they're talking about something on mainstream media, so absolutely.
Yeah, January's been full of all kinds of, you know, credit card leaks and things and compromises, so we'll probably have a pretty lengthy discussion about that, and then we'll follow it up with our technology picks of the week. Mm-hmm. So here we go. First today, we have our security spotlight, and it's a new year, and January marks an important month in the security field. What is this month designated as, Mike?
Well, it's kind of partly the end of this month and part of February, but it's Data Privacy Month, which kicked off Tuesday with Data Privacy Day, and, you know, it's they've been doing this since 2008, and it's to raise user awareness, the common person's awareness about your data and maintaining your privacy and what's happening to your data out in the cyber world. And I think this year will probably be have a lot more followers or a lot more attention with all the incidents we've been having.
Yeah, it's really becoming much more high profile. We were talking earlier, you know, right, just kind of the average everyday citizen with all the compromises. And I think a lot of this is coming out because we just, you know, coming off the Christmas holiday season in the shopping. But it seems like every day you're hearing another company that, you know, their usernames and accounts have been compromised in some way.
Right. And, you know, this is a worldwide, more of a worldwide event as opposed to a national event. What we call it Data Privacy Day or Month. And in Europe, they actually call it Data Protection Day and Month. So it's pretty interesting that it's a worldwide, like, because in October is Information Security Month, but that one's been kind of focused more on this side of the ocean, you would say, in this side of the hemisphere, and not a whole lot in Europe. But so it's pretty interesting. You know, we participated as much as we could. A lot, we tried to put out a lot of Twitter posts about it, retweets. I tried to make Eastern a champion for this, but I had a medical emergency, which kind of missed the deadline. Mm-hmm. Next year we'll try to become a champion of it.
Yeah. Now on Twitter, you know, uses hashtags all the time, and there's a hashtag out there, you know, the number symbol or the pound symbol DPM14 is the official, I think, Twitter. Yes. Twitter hashtag. And just doing a quick search out there, you know, trying to get myself educated a little bit, that's a good way. If you use Twitter and you have one of those unique hashtags, that's a good way to go out there and see what others are sharing. There's a lot of really good links to blog posts and some of the organizations, or, you know, some of the tips and tricks on, you know, how to make your accounts more secure. Of course, all the password changes and things.
Yes. And different councils, you know, especially like EDUCAUSE is a big higher education, and then they have their own little security section, which is Higher Education Information Security Council, which is followed by us, and we follow them on Twitter. But, you know, they focus on higher education, and they also leach down into primary and secondary school. Mm-hmm. For the information security information.
I think it's a lot of people, like when I used to hear data, I thought, okay, that's just for techies, you know, it's talking data. But now data really applies to all of us. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just data that's collected, it's just your information and your stuff that's out there now. And then also, I think when you had specific banks being targeted, a lot of them were the big banks, big money. Mm-hmm. Something like Target and Michaels and that, right, across all,
right, those were just announced,
all communities. I mean, it's everywhere and everybody. Right. And so I think that really raised some awareness.
And it raised awareness, and you see a lot of focus on the payment the payment card industry getting affected with the credit card hack at the point of sales machine, the POS machine is what they call it. But what concerns me the most is that was the 40 million people. The other additional 70 million people was an analytic database that they hacked into. It just gathered names and emails, and that shows. That's kind of a different trend. The golden nugget's always to get credit card information, right, or social security numbers.
It's not just to get money. It's
right. But with that information, it is possible, in how lax people are with what they post and what data they give out, on their own through Facebook and social media. Just having someone's email address with a name and a regular mailing address can make it pretty, I wouldn't say easy, but it gives them the avenue of a hacker to actually steal someone's identity or get some more of the, I like to call the golden nuggets, the social security number or some banking information to then exploit that. So, and that one's not being covered as much, but I think it should, because it can be just as serious as stealing the credit card information or your debit card information, because if it's just a debit card and credit card information, you can just cancel it and then that number is worthless. Whereas, it's hard to just cancel your name and your address and your email address.
Right, right.
And that stuff sticks with you a lot longer than
your
10-digit number.
I think you were saying earlier something like a third or something of Americans now have been...
Right, because I think around, if you take the population of America, and it was 110 million people just with the target, we're approaching a third of the population, technically was affected by the target. Even I was affected by it. In the 70 million analytic database, my information was in there because I had shopped a target two years ago.
Yeah, same thing for me with the Adobe.
Yeah.
I received that email from them saying, of that breach that we've been talking about for the last couple of months. But I do think the average person out there, it's hit their radar screen. And I think a lot of people are really checking their credit card bills closely for, some fraudulent charges and things.
And, on our department's blog, on our media person there, Tim, he came and kind of interviewed me about this and how concerned, and I just stated, I was like, you should have a daily knowledge of what's going on in your accounts for reasons like this, because there's really nothing as a consumer you can do to protect yourself from what happened at Target, especially if you get wrapped up in the credit card aspect. Mm-hmm. But you should be able to know that, okay, I see a charge that came through late last night for a $2,000 TV.
Right.
You call your company, call your bank right away and be like, I didn't do this.
Right.
But a lot of the banks are really good too. They have pretty instant, notification to you that something fishy is
going on. Yeah, I saw an article the other day, and I've not done this, and I don't know if I need to worry about it, but they said if you were planning on going on a trip, far away from home, you should contact your credit card company so your credit card doesn't get denied if I'm suddenly down in Texas getting a tank of gas or something.
Yeah, I've done that. Of course, I did that when I traveled abroad. The one trip to London and the one trip to Brazil that I took, I actually called my bank and said, I am doing this. This is my travel dates and my plans. And they put it on your record. They put it on your account.
Mm-hmm.
And then my bank was like, okay, well, call us when you get back. In case you ended up staying an extra few days or there was an issue with travel, call us when you get back and we'll take it off. And that way they know, your account, they won't deny charges stuff.
Ours, they did that they said, well, don't worry about calling anymore, but they send a text. So if we're someplace, like when we were in New York, we bought something and I got a text immediately and said, we just want to make sure that this is okay, and I sent him a text back and said yes it was. But we also had an issue.
It was a possible scam though, if somebody gets a hold of your phone number, you have to be careful there.
Yeah, well, it said you could text back or you could call a number, but
call this number that they provide for you to call.
Right. And it's like, but it was it was the same number, it was on the back of my credit card.
Yeah, so that's pretty good.
Yeah, you have to be so careful anymore.
Because there was an issue with one store that charged twice for the same thing. Mm-hmm. And then they called and said, hey, this just showed up twice from the same store.
Yeah.
And I immediately called them and they, took it off. And it was like, so that was, I appreciated that, that they were on top of things.
The other thing too with this whole thing and that blog post that we put out, and this was kind of being talked around, it was credit cards and debit cards for Target. Okay. I used to use my debit card a lot because it's like writing a check. It's mm-hmm. my money, so financially it makes sense. Where a credit card, I'm charging it, and then I got to pay that off. Mm-hmm. And that's how people get out of control. Like,
if you forget to pay it off,
or they just keep charging everything, and they're like, "Oh, I'll pay it off later," and then you got $13,000 worth of debt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But something like this though, and I think if you did any research, point out, debit card is your money.
Right.
So if something wrong happens, if something fraudulent, someone makes unapproved charges, you have to fight with the bank to get that back because it's your money. It's not their money. Now, mm-hmm. a credit card is their money.
Right.
And they're actually a lot more able to be like, yep, deny the charges or remove the charges from your account because it's their money. And then they just write that off.
Right.
Where you can't really write that off your bank account.
We actually dealt with that situation in our family. Somebody got a hold of our debit card. They created a card that they use down in Texas, somebody, but they wiped out our checking account, and our account is set up that if something happens and our checking account drops, it draws from our savings. Mm. So they wiped out our checking account and were pulling out of our savings, and the bank let us know. Mm-hmm. And then it took about 5 or 6 days to get it figured out before we had that money back in there.
Right.
And so luckily we had a little cushion to make it, but we said if that would have happened to one of our sons or a lot of young people or people that just are doing paycheck to paycheck, that would be gone. And what would they do?
Yep.
So. Yeah.
Or there's the other tricks, like you can have two checking accounts. And it's like I have that. I have one that's like my.
Yeah, I keep a separate primary. Like online type act transactions. Yeah,
like I have one that's just for like bill pay, and doing an online bill pay with my bank for my, bills. Mm-hmm. And then I have my other one that I put a small amount of money to use for my debit card. So if something were to happen to that.
Yeah.
Card or something, they're going to get some money, but not a lot.
Same thing with all these online services and things, like iTunes or Google Play or whatever, whenever you're buying the apps and things, I have a separate one for those transactions, or actually a gift card, because whenever that goes down, I feel much safer with a gift card than, I don't like to do that with a regular card just to prevent some of that.
Right.
So, okay. Well, we will provide a link out in the show notes, specifically, for the higher education community, the EDUCAUSE link, and they've got quite a resource list here for Data Privacy Month. Right.
And then, the National Security Council, they're the actual national one supporting this Data Privacy Day. And like I said, if from the website, you'll see that EDUCAUSE is a champion of it.
Okay, so we'll go ahead and wrap it up here, and be safe, everyone. My technology pick of the week this week is a new Chromebook that I recently purchased as an early Christmas gift to myself, and I've been blogging about some of my experiences.
It's a real early Christmas gift.
Well, it was about a week before Christmas. You might want
For last year.
For last year. Well, I haven't got to this year's. Work on this year's.
You might want to say a post-Christmas gift, a delayed Christmas gift.
Okay. So anyway, this Chromebook, many K-12 schools are really starting to experiment, and Chromebooks are suddenly becoming a very hot item in the K-12, and it's also moving its way up to higher ed. But a Chromebook is essentially a laptop-style computer that runs Google's Chrome operating system. So that's where it gets its name, Chromebook. And it is essentially a stripped-down, a very Spartan version of Linux. And the idea behind it is it's basically just the Chrome browser, and that's what you use to connect and do your work on the internet. So one of the attractive features is it's a very low price point. They typically start about $199 and go, up from there, but, typically under $500. And they just did come out with some of the new touchscreen models, so those are working their way through. And I've got a blog out there that I'm going to be adding to here in the coming days about some of my experiences that I've had. But for the most part, I've been very pleased with it. I did get the touchscreen model, so I'll share some of the benefits and some of the limitations, I guess, for that. But the big thing with Chromebooks is you really need to be connected to an internet, so you need to be around a Wi-Fi source because they are designed for internet access.
So if it's something a school has, if they're sending them home as students,
they need to have Wi-Fi.
Need to have
Wi-Fi access at home, which, you know, is a limitation, you know, particularly in some of our areas here in rural Illinois. But also, it's meant to run the Google Eagle system for those schools that are out there doing Google Apps for Education. It's just kind of a natural fit. So if you're doing Google Docs or Google Spreadsheets and Slides, and then, of course, Google Drive. But everything's out there in the cloud.
Nice.
So I'm really liking it. I'm kind of working around. One reason that I purchased it was, you know, a lot of fellow teachers, especially in K-12, have these. So I'm just trying to work through some of the limitations. And you know, one of the things that I find interesting is you can also use, since I use OneNote, Microsoft OneNote, I can also log into, you know, SkyDrive or what's going to be called OneDrive. They're going to change the name, but I have access to all of those as well. So it's an interesting concept. A lot of schools are looking at these for one-to-one programs, and then also for some of the national testing and things that are going on, because they're going to have to provide devices for some online testing.
And so, are they pretty durable and lightweight, and can, you know, can survive a class of second graders?
I bought the Acer model, and this one, you know, is just a well-made laptop. Some of the earlier ones, there were some quality issues with them coming up, but, you know, the manufacturers and things, you know, it's a typical little laptop, and like I said, for $199, it provides a lot of value, I think, as long as you do have that internet connection. So that's my tech pick.
Very cool. All right, well, I picked something. It's not, you know, it's not software or anything like that. It's sort of different, but it is one more way that technology has come into play and become part of what we do. With what I do with the Teaching with Primary Sources program here at EIU, it's using primary sources in the classroom to teach. It's also important, you know, okay, so the Library of Congress has, I believe, what, almost 50 million items digitized now, and they're accessible on the internet to anybody that wants to use them. And that's great, but more local communities are doing this, and not just, you know, state, but local communities themselves and counties and historic areas and just all kinds of cool things like that. And so I stumbled across an article about a South Bronx group of students that found the site of a slave burial ground. And what it was is a teacher or someone in their Department of Ed for the city found this photograph, and all it had on the photo was, it just had written on the back of it, Slave Burying Ground, Hunts Point Road. And it was from 1910, and so the students, their teacher was really into doing this research, and so the teacher got the whole class involved, and they found all sorts of old maps, wills, diaries, photographs of the community and all that, and discovered that there is a slave burial ground. And actually, in the end, the United States Department of Agriculture brought in ground-penetrating radar to the site and found suggested skeletal remains about 6 feet under. And so this had been covered with a blacktop, asphalt, you know, just...
So a case where modern technologies are allowing you to go back and do some investigations.
And it's connecting, you know, the need these kids had to find this from this old photograph that luckily somebody saved. This one photograph and labeled the photo with what it was, because otherwise people may have just seen it and tossed it. But because of where it was and the interest, they started asking all these other people. All these pieces, all these different departments and entities came together and did this research. Now they found this. They're cleaning it up and designating it as this area of something of historic significance in this community. And so I just thought that was such, one, it shows how important it is that we all have pictures, our photos that we have on our cameras and other places. We need to save those, and maybe it is a good idea to print them out and title them and write where they are and what they are, and to save those things, because the technology, you know, 200 years from now is going to be very different.
What's JPEG? It's like, are we going to be able to do?
Well, we're kind of like that now with the floppy disks.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
If I find an old one in a cabinet, how am I going to view it?
Right. And so, you know, we want to make sure that 200 years from now, our great-grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren can all know what these are, and they're not just lost forever when my phone's done.
Right, and you talk about that with your teaching with primary sources and doing the digital preservation with the different formats and things, you know, some of the physical things, and it's just got to be a huge, never-ending job for Library of Congress.
Oh, absolutely, but, you know, there's some things that it's kind of nice to have on a piece of paper.
Yeah, absolutely.
And just to keep and to have, and Mike's over here rolling his eyes at me, Mr. No Paper, but and I
we'll be select with it.
I tell everyone, you know, there's it's so easy, so easy to make a digital book. Mm-hmm. So if you have some old family history things, even recipes or pictures or anything at all, it doesn't have to be this story that's all written out, but just, you know, put some things together and just call it a scrapbook and give it to the next generation.
Right.
Because that's something that'll be saved.
Right. Well, it's a hybrid approach. You know, sometimes, you know, we go 100%, you know, going the paperless things. We recently, my wife and I digitized some old family recipes and things that we had, you know, from some of the, so that's kind of going from that physical world. But at the same time, you know, as you say, some of those digital resources, select ones that, you know, mean a lot, you know, for family reasons to go out and make a hard copy of it.
Right. So it's this full circle, but you're covering all your bases.
Right.
And that way you're protecting what you have and what's valuable or what's important to you.
Yeah.
And making sure that someday down the road it'll be there for the next generation to use. So I just thought that was such a cool story. And I would guarantee a couple of those kids in that class.
Oh, they'll never. Yeah, that's a project they won't, you know, forget.
They won't forget, and it may spur them into either history, architecture, archaeology, city planning, anything. But it's going to be a catapult for somebody into something big.
Okay, Mike.
Well, my tech pick isn't really anything new and groundbreaking, but you know, it was something that came in very useful for me about 2 weeks ago. I actually had to have my appendix removed. 2 weeks ago, and it was my first surgery that I ever had. And you know, I woke up in the middle of the night with pain, and you know, just kind of for like an hour or so, just kind of tossed it off. It was just, you know, just whatever, you know, something weird that would go away. And when it didn't go away, you know, the first thing I did was go to Google and find like a WebMD or other blogs just to describe what the pain is. And, you know, I'm not a professional and I, you know, I'm not a doctor, and I know everyone posting on there really isn't a doctor either. But for me, it was nice to know that, okay, I don't have something, it was sort of serious, but it wasn't serious where like I had to call 911 and go, you know, and get to the ER. Absolutely, like I could take a little time and you know, see how things were going. But it was still nice to have that assurance that, like, okay, I kind of have an idea what's going on here.
Do a little bit of research.
Or that assurance that, you know, I need to go see a doctor.
Right.
You know, I need to get a professional's opinion about this, where it's not just, oh, I have a pulled muscle or, you know, just a little tweak here, a tweak there. You know, it was something that was like, okay, this is, you know, it was good to have that reassurance. You know, everyone's different, and that's why I was like, oh, I need to go see it.
Right, see. That wraps it up for episode 161 of Tech Talk for Teachers. Show notes for this episode and archived episodes are available on the web at the EIU Instructional Technology Center website at eiu.edu/ITC. To leave a comment or suggestion, please send an email to techtalk@eiu.edu or leave a comment on the Tech Talk for Teachers blog. Until next time, this is Tom Grissom.
I'm Cindy Rich.
I'm Mike Joya.
Keep on learning.